This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 9 was recorded on May 27th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Dr. Pippa Malmgren is back. And Pippa, holy cow, talk about topics for Pippa this week. Let's start with the whole China trade deal, because I think so many people are confused. At first, it seemed pretty clear with all of this U.S. versus Huawei stuff that it seemed like maybe this was just saber rattling, a little bit of negotiation tactics. And I think the market kind of assumed, okay, Trump and Xi are going to, you know, wave their sabers and do their thing. And surely within a few days after that, a deal's going to come together after all. So far, no such luck. Is this thing really falling apart the way it seems, or is this negotiating tactics?
Well, it can be both at the same time, and I think it is. So let's be clear as well. This is not only about the one company. It's not just about Huawei. It's about all the Chinese providers of data systems. And I think that's why the White House and the Office of Homeland Defense came out with a very specific statement about, for example, Chinese-made drones. And, you know, I'm in that sector myself. So basically, they've been saying for quite a while from Washington, this is about all Chinese entities that are in the business of gathering and transmitting data. So it's much bigger than the one company. And the fact that the Chinese have responded by saying, actually, they didn't say anything. What they did is they had Xi Jinping go to visit the largest rare earth metal refinery in China, just to make a visual statement that the thing is, almost all of the refining capability of rare earth metals in the world is now in China. And the reason it's there is because nobody in the West wanted it, because it's such a toxic anti-environment process. But the reality is, every single thing that we use during our day, from the electric toothbrush to the mobile phone to the car to anything with a battery, all these things totally depend on refined rare earth materials. Now, this last week, I've been in conversation with people on Twitter, and they're all like, no, there are rare earths all over the world. Yes, but they're useless unless you refine them. And the refining process is so very environmentally taxing that basically you can't do it in the West very easily. And to get the permissions to do it with new technology, yes, it's maybe possible, but that could be at least a decade. I would say that process would be worse than getting FDA approval, or, you know, even getting approval from the EPA for a traditional oil and gas refinery. This stuff is much worse. So there's a definite upping of the ante between the two countries. I still stand by my long-held view that the White House, Trump, and China, Xi Jinping, are trying to reach a point where they can announce a comprehensive deal that involves everything from the reduction of the nuclear threat and the potential towards some kind of cessation of the difficulties between North and South Korea, plus something about China's blue water policy, including the South China Sea, plus something about what's the nature of the framework for the relationship over data. And it's a big ask, but that's what Trump has been doing from the start, is saying, let's do this as one big comprehensive bilateral picture, instead of trying to negotiate each of these things individually in the context of, say, the World Trade Organization. And because everybody knows, once Trump leaves office, if he does leave, that this kind of deal will never be offered by any other president. So I still think the chances are we'll get to something, but it is getting very noisy on the way.
You know, I want to ask you about the way this has gone down, because you've worked in the White House, you've advised presidents, you know a lot about this whole diplomatic process. And needless to say, President Trump has a slightly different style than a lot of conventional leaders. But something I learned from living in Asia is that Asian culture is quite a lot different than what we're used to in the West. And particularly, it seems to me that the Trump administration's tactic here seems to be to publicly shame and humiliate the Chinese side, hoping that that will cause them to become more cooperative. And I don't know if it's just me, Pippa, but it seems like, in my experience, shaming and publicly humiliating Asians never works. I don't think it ever causes them to suddenly want to cooperate more. Is the Trump administration kind of blowing it here from a cultural standpoint in terms of understanding how to deal with the Chinese culture as they work through this negotiation?
Well, I don't know that it's so exclusive to Chinese culture. I mean, I don't think teenagers respond very well to it either, or middle-class workers, or frankly, human beings don't like this approach. So that's one thing. But here's the bigger thing is, it's such an interesting situation as an observer that the military and security establishment on both sides has been well aware of stress and tension for more than a decade now. You know, in the West, people who would be in NATO and in the highest levels of strategic security, they describe a lot of what's happening as sub-threshold. And what they mean is, it's just underneath the level where you would actually declare that you're in conflict. And that includes not just the words that are being spoken around, say, trade policy or, you know, 5G and all that, but also just from a security point of view, what's happening on the high seas between the Chinese military and Western militaries, what's happening in terms of their presence in different parts of the world. So what we've had is a world where everybody knew there was a problem, but nobody wanted to say it. And Trump has said, well, I'll say it out loud. And the way in which he said it is particularly aggressive and confrontational, as is consistent with the way he tends to address everything. The question is there a way for the Chinese to, quote, win? And in the end, negotiations have to be win-win, right? No, unless you're actually at war. And even then, it's not smart to leave your opponent feeling entirely defeated, as we've learned from our experience, you know, with Russia, for example. You're like, you're not supposed to, when you win, as it were, you're supposed to help them get back on the ladder of success. And this is that kind of situation where the way in which the things are being said may be as influential as what's being said. But what is clear is that the public is only just catching up with this situation, which everybody in the inner circle's known about for years.
Pippa, last time we had you on a feature interview, this is going back several months now, you hit us with a very non-consensus view, the possibility that President Trump might, at the 11th hour, pull out and not even run for re-election, preferring instead to launch his own cable news network. Give us an update. Do you still think that is likely to happen? And what is your current outlook as far as how likely President Trump is to seek re-election?
Look, let's understand it in the context of the last 20 years. All presidents have tried to turn their experience in the White House into some kind of media brand, with only really one exception, which is the president I worked for, President George W. Bush. He went off and basically started chopping wood. But everybody else has wanted to create some kind of platform with media profile and influence. And that includes the Clintons, that includes the Obamas. Frankly, other countries, we've seen this as well, you know, Tony Blair, because the power of the media, in other words, what's changed in the last 20 years is that media is so powerful and arguably more powerful than politics. So when I argued that I think there's a possibility that President Trump will want to go from politics into media because media is a bigger, stronger platform than the White House these days. And here we have a person who's very skilled at managing the media, even from that platform, bypassing all the traditional approaches to media messaging and doing so very, very successfully. You know, whether you like the message or not, it's hard to argue with the fact that he does seem to control headlines. So based on that, I think there is this possibility. And frankly, I think future presidents are also going to want to do this conversion, and that they would be right in their assessment that that kind of a media platform, something that might have everything from general entertainment to political talk shows would be an extremely powerful position. And let's face it, what Rupert Murdoch have done and Berlusconi is hugely influential in how people think. So yeah, I still think this is a possibility. Everybody argues with me about timing because they assume that staying in the White House is more prestigious than doing this. And I'm just saying the opposite. I think launching a media platform would be much more prestigious, give you more influence, generate more cash, all sorts of things that are upside that a person who comes from a business background would appreciate, but people from politics don't particularly.
Let's move on to the subject of populism generally around the globe. This is something you and I have both been watching for more than a decade, but boy, things are boiling over. In Europe, they're winning. So where is this headed? Are we moving in a direction that threatens the European Union, or are we looking at maybe new leadership that's going to make it stronger than it ever was?
Yeah, so you and I have talked about this for a long time. And when I wrote my book Signals back in 2015, and I argued that populism was about to really get an uplift and that we should really think about the root causes, people were like, don't be ridiculous. That's never going to happen. Well, it keeps happening. And now it's happening in a European context, not just a British context. But even in Britain, the European voting has created a strong foundation for believing that actually the British public are probably going to vote more heavily to the right than before in the domestic election process, or they're going to favor that kind of outcome. And so now Britain is, you know, split between the people who really want a Brexit and happy to have a hard Brexit, and the people who really, really don't want Brexit at all. And the number of the first camp is gaining, and the number of the second camp isn't. So markets don't like this because it means uncertainty. And I think that's the issue for the continent as well. But I still say for the continent, the same set of issues are unfolding. And the more the European Union talks about full harmonization of every kind of policy and ends the old concept of subsidiarity, which meant that, you know, national governments had a great deal of control over certain aspects of policy, that more and more we're going to see Europe having exactly the same internal argument that the British are having. So here's my bottom line. People, whatever their political opinion, they should be careful not to confuse their political opinion with the profit opportunity from an investment point of view. And you can say, I don't like populism, but step back and take a look and say, okay, but if you get more of it in the UK, and that probably causes sterling to fall, then probably that actually gives a boost to all the exporters. And therefore, there's a market move to anticipate there. But I think people are so emotionally caught up in one side or the other, they find it very difficult to disentangle their emotional position from their trading position.
Let's move on to another subject, which is very difficult for investors to separate where the market may be headed, and as we just try to figure out what the actual situation is. And that, of course, is U.S. and Iran. Investors are having a hard time understanding exactly what's going on here. And are John Bolton and President Trump on the same page, or have they fallen out of agreement with one another? What do you think comes next in this whole Iran situation that's unfolding?
So again, I've argued for quite a long time that geopolitics is back on the landscape. I wrote a book in 2015, actually, called Geopolitics for Investors. And it was fascinating at that time. People were like, who cares about geopolitics? And I was like, I think it's making a comeback and we need to get ready for this. Well, now it has come back. And I think that we have a generation of investors who are so deeply unfamiliar with this territory that they feel nothing but fear when they see these headlines. And I think that they, again, they miss opportunities here because it's just a shutdown. They go, I can't deal with this. So here's the thing. I do think the president can't do very much on domestic policy because of the configuration of the Congress. So he's going to spend most of his time from now until the end of this term on foreign policy. In the realm of foreign policy, he has a highly unusual situation where he's got both Saudi and Israel aligned with the United States and their dislike of Iran's current leadership, not the country, but the current leadership. And we shouldn't be surprised to hear more provocative language between that group of countries and Iran. Now, once the president started to say troops and sending in material and creating this the impression that he was ready to start pulling triggers, then the establishment steps in and he's stepped down from that position. And now you see him saying no war, you know, no regime change. But nonetheless, this is really about the lay of the land in the Middle East and a shifted geopolitical environment from what we used to have. So the big question is, what bets do people want to make on this? And one of them, which is related to our earlier conversation, is who's the biggest buyer of oil from both Iran and Saudi now? Answer, China. So the real question is, where is China on all this? And one argument that you hear a lot, maybe worth thinking about, is, you know, we live in a world today where weapons sales have absolutely skyrocketed. I think it's a very unfortunate and disturbing feature of the landscape. But it's not just the West anymore. China is also in this space, too. So when you add in weapon sales, oil sales, it starts to be worthy of our attention to ask who benefits under what circumstances, and then think through, okay, what are the implications of that? So I'm just saying this is a space to watch, not because I think we're going to be at war, but because I think this idea of sub-threshold conflict, so it's not what the public really sees because it's like on page 14, but it's noisy enough to be serious for the markets and to have market implications.
Pippa, before we let you go, you mentioned a couple of your books, Geopolitics for Investors and Signals. You didn't even mention Leadership Lab, which actually was voted the best business book of 2018. Tell our listeners, please, before we go, just a little bit more about the books, where they can follow your work, what your Twitter handle is, and so forth.
Yeah, sure. So my Twitter handle is Dr. Pippa M, and I'm pretty active on there. And my books are all on Amazon. They're all about different subjects. You know, Geopolitics, Signals is about the world economy and populism. And the Leadership Lab is more about getting a sense of the current landscape so you can orient yourself in order to know where we are. Because so many people, they don't even understand data and how it works. And you can't orient yourself if you don't really understand basic things like that. And then I'm working on my next one, but that's about drones and data. But that's early days, early, early days.
Well, I'll look forward to getting an update on the new book as you get a little bit further along. Meanwhile, Pippa, we look forward to getting an update from you in a few weeks when we have you back here on All Stars. Listeners, we've got Luke Groman and Danielle DiMartino Booth on deck later this week in All Stars. As far as Energy Week this week, we've got Ole Hansen, Pat Hemsworth, and Chris Cook. And of course, we'll have our regular Macro Voices podcast on Thursday. For Macro Voices, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.